You're listening to the Body Pros CME and CE podcast coverage of ICAC 2007, the 47th Annual Interscience Conference on Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy. To learn more about this CME and CE activity, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/ICAAC2007.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the Body Pros coverage of ICAC 2007, which took place September 17th through the 20th in Chicago, Illinois. I'm Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of the Body Pro, and I'm here with two of the top HIV clinician researchers in the United States. First up will be Dr. Cal Cohn, research director of Community Research Initiative of New England and Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates in Boston. He's also a clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Cohn will walk us through the big story of ICAC, new antiretrovirals and antiretrovirals still in development. Welcome, Dr. Cohn. What did you take away from ICAC in terms of breaking research for first-line therapy?
Probably the single most important study in terms of first-line regimens was a study called Artemis. Artemis was a large study. 689 people, in fact, were treatment-naive who entered this study. And the only eligibility was a viral load greater than 5,000. The design was straightforward. Everybody received the same two nucleosides, tenofovir and FTC, and either Kaletra, lopinavir or ritonavir, or darunavir. What makes this study novel and important is that darunavir was tested at a new 800 milligram once daily dose with 100 milligrams ritonavir, both taken once a day. The lopinavir was typically given twice a day, although, as some of your listeners probably know, in some countries, including the U.S., lopinavir has been approved for use in treatment-naive patients given once a day. And so, based on country regulations where the patient was living, lopinavir could be dosed once a day or twice a day. Similarly, the Meltrex tablet formulation happened while this study was ongoing, and so approximately 83% of patients who started on capsule had the opportunity to switch to the Meltrex tablet of Kaletra during this study. The endpoint was the typical one, percent whose viral load is less than 50 after a year, with the usual secondary endpoints that we see for other metrics of success, both safety and efficacy. The study population is pretty typical of many of our studies, although 30% were women, which is more than all of the other studies of darunavir, but otherwise was pretty similar to most of the other criteria. The viral load was around 70,000, CD4s in the 220 range, and about 13% had co-infection with Hep B or Hep C. Now, after a year, one of the findings of note was that actually very few patients overall discontinued the study during the year. Indeed, only about 12 to 16% discontinued during the year. There was a small difference favoring darunavir in terms of loss to follow-up or due to adverse event rates, in that 3% stopped this study for adverse events on darunavir and 7% stopped it on lopinavir. But otherwise, there was pretty similar in about 1 to 2% for other reasons over the course of the study. But the big news was really virologic. And what we saw after a year is that 84% of people on darunavir once a day had a viral load less than 50, in contrast, 78% on lopinavir. Now, lopinavir did quite well at 78%, but darunavir just did a little bit better. So the statistics of that difference, of that 6% difference, were presented to us. The point of this study, of course, was to demonstrate that darunavir once daily, 800-100, was not inferior to standard dose lopinavir. And indeed, it's clearly not inferior. It's, in fact, 6% better in this study. And so the protocol statistics said that if we have shown non-inferiority, then let's test for superiority. And that 5.5% difference was tested, and the p-value for superiority was 0.06. So the study could not prove superiority, but certainly did clearly suggest that darunavir was at least as good as lopinavir based on virologic suppression. But it's really the subsets that I think clarified some of the more interesting findings rather than just the overall data. For example, most of the patients had viral loads below 100,000, although about 40% were above 5 log at baseline. For those who entered with viral loads below 100,000, the results were almost identical, 85 to 86% less than 50 after a year. But for those above 5 log, what we saw was 79% on darunavir versus 67% on lopinavir got their viral load below 50. This difference of 12% was actually statistically significantly different, with the p-value below 0.05, certainly suggesting that in this particular subset, durunavir once a day could be a better option than lopinavir based on at least these results. There was also a similar trend for suggesting that more advanced patients did better on durunavir. By CD4 counts, we saw about a 10% difference favoring durunavir for CD4 counts less than 200, and including the subset less than 50, we saw, again, 77% on durunavir versus 67% on lopinavir getting their viral load controlled. In contrast, above 200 cells, 87 and 84% on the two drugs got their viral load controlled. Now, as I mentioned, lopinavir could be used once or twice a day. And so some people took once-a-day lopinavir throughout the course of the study. Others took twice a day. A small number actually switched between once-a-day and twice-a-day, and they were excluded from a particular analysis that looked to explore how much the schedule of lopinavir influenced its results. And so overall, while lopinavir had 78% less than 50, what was interesting is that lopinavir twice a day, 81% were less than 50. Versus on lopinavir once a day, 71% had viral loads less than 50. Now, this 10% difference has certainly been seen in at least one other study before for the difference between twice a day and once a day based on schedule. And here it is corroborated a second time. And it is fair to point out that lopinavir twice a day did as well as durunavir once a day, 81 and 84% getting their viral load less than 50. So certainly one way to look at this is that durunavir once a day does about as well as lopinavir twice a day. And really the main concern here was both at high viral load strata as well as lopinavir once a day, we do see a difference favoring durunavir. Now, we don't see a difference in terms of CD4 responses. They're essentially identical as they typically are in studies in which almost everybody gets viral load suppression. And the CD4 counts were not broken down further by high viral load strata or other differences I just mentioned. There was also an analysis of the implications of not establishing virologic suppression, since while most people did, there were some who did not. There were some cases of virologic failure. And so the implications of virologic failure were presented to us, and what we saw is that in those patients who had virologic failure, we saw that there were, as typical, very few resistance mutations in these populations. Indeed, no one on durunavir and only one person on lopinavir developed protease resistance mutations, and one person on durunavir, two on lopinavir, developed nucleoside resistance, once again suggesting that, as is typical of boosted PIs, not only is there minimal PI resistance, but there's actually minimal regimen resistance. Now, I mentioned some of the dropouts due to adverse events at the beginning of the talk, and so in terms of overall adverse events, it's not surprising that one of the few that were observed was diarrhea. Since lopinavir as a capsule was used in some patients during the course of the trial, and the rates of grades 2 through 4 diarrhea were 10% for lopinavir and 4% on durunavir, certainly supporting that the once-a-day durunavir is generally pretty well tolerated. Now, there's been a concern for rash on durunavir because it is a sulfa drug, but in fact only 3% of patients on durunavir developed a rash of grades 2, 3, and 4. 1% on lopinavir did. And it was also noted that there were no toxicities in terms of renal serious adverse events, no renal discontinuations, and indeed the creatinine clearance was stable on the two arms for 48 weeks, and that's important because obviously this was the use of tenofovir FTC with either boosted PI. In terms of other laboratory toxicities, there were very few, and they were very similar in the arms, with 10% or fewer having transaminase elevations. Pancreatic amylase and lipase were seen in a few patients, but again, similar in the two arms. In terms of lipids, what we saw is a difference in terms of triglycerides, 11% on lopinavir versus 3% on durunavir, having a grade 2 and above triglyceride elevations. But interestingly, total cholesterol to HDL ratio was essentially superimposable on these two drugs, and certainly suggesting that both once a day and twice a day, durunavir versus and lopinavir had similar lipid outcomes overall, except for the triglyceride fraction, which clearly favored durunavir. There was more of a triglyceride bump on lopinavir, as we might expect from previous studies. And so why did darunavir once a day work so well? And the last slide of the presentation was, in fact, that issue. The pharmacokinetics of once-a-day darunavir is sufficient so that in the population who entered the study, there was a sample done for what's called population PK, population pharmacokinetics. And what was found is that the lowest sample obtained in this population during the course of the trial was still several-fold above the Cmin target concentration for this drug, suggesting that the dose of 800 to 100 is sufficient in essentially all of the patients to provide adequate exposure to see virus suppression at the high rates that we did. Now, of course, that's also true for lopinavir twice a day, as I mentioned, but what we see here is data giving us confidence that this once-daily PI can do very well, can do, in fact, as well as our gold standard lopinavir twice a day. And then in contrast, lopinavir once a day may not be quite as successful as we might have hoped from previous studies, although because that high viral load stratification is also there, we'll need additional information to sort out, was it the high viral load issue? Was it the once-a-day issue? Which issue was it that had resulted in the differences of lopinavir? It's hard to know. It wasn't broken down further. Nevertheless, I think what we've got here is great confidence that darunavir once-a-day is an important treatment option for the protease inhibitor class, even in treatment-naive patients, certainly to supplement the broad portfolio of studies we've seen in treatment-experienced patients.
Uh-huh. How are these results going to play out in the clinic?
Well, I think at this point, darunavir has been used nearly exclusively in treatment-experienced patients, if only because that's where the bulk of the data have been. The POWER studies and then the TITAN studies have been in either heavily PI pretreated or minimally PI pretreated. And now we've got data in completely untreated patient populations, once again showing that darunavir does at least as well, if not perhaps sometimes better, than our standard of care alternatives. So I think for those clinicians who have a patient who's treatment naive, certainly we still have our non-nucleoside class. There's certainly nothing here that makes the protease inhibitors superior to our standard non-nucleoside approaches. But if somebody is looking at initiating a protease inhibitor, I think it's fair to say that twice-a-day lopinavir did well, as did once-daily darunavir. And I think if patients are preferring once-daily regimens, we now have another one to choose from. Again, this doesn't discount the possibility still for atazanavir or even fosimprenavir, but it certainly, in a very large study, gives us confidence that darunavir deserves to be in that conversation.
Antiretrovirals in development, I think, was the real story of ICAC 2007. Can you discuss some of the highlights?
Sure. We saw new information about novel classes as well as new drugs in familiar classes. Let's start with one of the big studies in the field, the study that called DUET that is evaluating the new non-nucleoside called etravirine in treatment-experienced patients. This study, DUET 1 and DUET 2, was combined here, and so we saw a combined analysis of roughly 1,200 people who participated in these two randomized studies. The design is a simple one. It's etravirine or a placebo with a background regimen containing darunavir, optimized nucleosides, and the option to use enfuvirtide. The key to this study, of course, is that etravirine is being developed for non-nucleoside-resistant virus, and so patients had to have a history of, or at the time of entry, evidence of resistance to the non-nucleosides. Otherwise, patients were also eligible because they had at least three or more primary protease mutations, suggesting that this was a pretty heavily pretreated population. So in terms of demographics, the study enrolled mostly men, 90% males, about 70% of whom were white. Their viral load's pretty high, 4.8 log, and their CD4s are pretty low, around 100 cells, not surprising for a triple-class experienced patient population with at least three protease mutations. Of interest is that about half of the patients used enfuvirtide on the study, although only about a quarter started enfuvirtide for the first time while on this study. Also of note is that a fair number of patients had a regimen that was pretty compromised, meaning that when we look at the optimized background, about 16-17% had no other fully active antivirals in their background regimen, and that it was either etravirine or placebo with a compromised background for that small subset. Nevertheless, despite these advanced patient populations, Etrivirine did exactly what it was designed to do. It improved the response rate by about 50%, meaning it was a 41% response rate without etrivirine and 59% with it. So 40 to about 60 means an improvement by about a 50% improvement. And not surprisingly, the change in viral load out to week 24 was also considerably more, statistically more, by about 0.7 log on the etrivirine versus the placebo arm. Similarly, there was a CD4 benefit of around 20 cells, a difference that became clinically significant, not just statistically significant, as we'll get into in a couple of moments. The virologic suppression was actually kind of interesting, particularly with regards to the question around using enfuvirtide. In recent analyses of this study, what was noted is that etrivirine clearly demonstrated activity in the patients who did not have fully active enfuvirtide. In the subset, for example, who either recycled enfuvirtide or didn't use it at all, etrivirine clearly improved the response rate. It went from about a third to just over a half of the patients getting their viral load suppressed to less than 50 at week 24. But in the subset of people who used enfuvirtide for the first time, when the data were presented for the first time in the Sydney conference, we saw similar numbers, about 65% on average, in the two arms who had viral load suppression, and that we didn't see the additional benefit of etrivirine if enfuvirtide was used in the regimen. And so the statisticians were asked to help us understand that, since where is the effect of etrivirine? Just because enfuvirtide's there doesn't mean etrivirine becomes inactive. What explained this? And it turns out that by chance there was an explanation, in that in those patients who got etrivirine, they also had, just by chance, more compromised darunavir. Again, recall that everybody took a darunavir in this study. And by chance, more of the people who were assigned to get etrivirine had higher phenotypic resistance to the darunavir. And so when that difference is adjusted for, what we again see is the statistical advantage for using etrivirine versus the placebo, in that what we saw was about a 10% improvement, 11% improvement in the response rate of etrivirine or no etrivirine in those patients who had enfuvirtide in their background regimen. Consistent with what we've learned for, again, several years now, which is it's not just picking active drugs, it's picking active regimens. And so overall, what we saw is that the use of etrivirine was clearly dramatically important in the subset of people who had no fully active drugs. Active is, again, determined by a phenotypic score suggesting that the drug was not fully active. And it's actually pretty impressive that for the subset of people who had no fully active drugs and they received the placebo arm, only 8% got their viral load less than 50. But etrivirine and that same compromised background regimen, 45% got the viral loads less than 50. Not something we would have expected from a non-nucleoside in a non-nucleoside-resistant population, a dramatic difference illustrating that this is not just a typical non-nucleoside with a fragility in a compromised background, but certainly a much more durable response. Nevertheless, as we add additionally active drugs, we got better response. We're up to 60% with one additional active drug, and we're up to 74% for people who had two or more active drugs. Now, the issue with, of course, new drugs in existing classes is there can be resistance mutations that confer cross-resistance to new drugs like etrivirine. Etrivirine is no exception. There are, in fact, 13 non-nucleoside resistance mutations that can confer resistance to etrivirine, and the impact of those was, again, reviewed in this presentation. The subset of people who had none of these etrivirine-associated mutations, 75% of them got their viral load less than 50. In contrast, if somebody had three or more etrivirine mutations, their response rate's down to 41% or less. Again, consistent with what we understand, which is this is a great drug for the right person, but unfortunately there are resistance mutations that can impact its response. Thankfully, in the population, at least that enrolled in DUET, only about 16% of the patients who entered this study had three or more etrivirine-relevant resistance mutations, suggesting that these mutations are not common in the population. Now, I mentioned earlier that the CD4 count was clinically significant, not just statistically significant, and how we learned that was a pretty unique presentation that we don't see at most of these studies But with 1,200 patients, you can learn some additional findings. So one of the things that, of course, we're trying to do is not just change numbers, but help people stay healthier. And in as little as 24 weeks, there was evidence that people were, in fact, healthier. In the overall population, there was a trend of reduced numbers of AIDS-defining illnesses or death in those who got etravirine versus no etravirine. But when they looked at the subset of people who were in some ways the most in trouble, the subset who either did not use enfuvirtide or had recycled enfuvirtide, the subset of people who were the most in trouble clinically, then there were statistically fewer clinical events in the subset who got etravirine versus placebo. It was 3.8% on etravirine and 8.3% on the placebo arm, developing some clinical illness, even in as little as 24 weeks, with a highly significant finding, not just for statistics, but for patients. So what are the downsides to this drug? What are the cautions? Well, really, the only one that was identified is about a rate of rash in about 8% of patients. There's no nervous system disorders, as we see with other drugs like efavirenz. There were certainly no abnormal dreams reported in any difference versus placebo, and no difference in hepatic adverse events, as we see with other non-nucleosides like nevirapine. But the rash is worth some attention, since it happened at a rate of 8% greater on drug versus placebo. And as is true with most of these drugs, the rash typically happens in week 2 and typically lasts for about 2 weeks. Thankfully, the rashes were grades 1, 2, and 3. There were no grade 4 rashes, meaning no Stevens-Johnson. 2% of patients did discontinue permanently, but most of the other patients could treat through their rash. And of interest is that the rash incidence, the rate is higher in women, but the severity or discontinuations are similar by gender. But for whatever reason, it's just more common to have a rash in women than in men. The rash was not associated with CD4 counts or other characteristics of our patients, nor was there evidence that it was higher rate in people who had a history of non-nucleoside rash. So etravirine looks like a very important drug. While it's not yet approved, it is available in expanded access protocols, and clearly the use of etravirine certainly improved the response rates, and depending on the activity of the regimen, what we can see is a consistent, relevant activity to etravirine. Of course, realizing that there are, unfortunately, some percent of patients who will have too many resistance mutations to take advantage of this drug, but thankfully the majority of patients, as I mentioned, 86%, have less than 3 mutations conferring resistance. So this drug looks like it will be an important drug for people with a history of non-nucleoside resistance.
When is it expected for this drug to be approved?
Well, as we understand it, it'll be sometime. Obviously, the FDA has to review the data, but if the data continue to be as good as the data shown here, it would have to be sometime next year, since certainly the FDA has not had a committee meeting about this drug, and so odds are good it's going to be sometime in 2008. The next class we should focus on are the integrase inhibitor data for treatment-experienced patients. If for no other reason, then we certainly are seeing a lot of enthusiasm for this class based on the results of Merck's benchmark trial illustrating just how interesting these integrase inhibitors can be in the treatment-experienced populations. But the interest in these drugs actually started about a year ago at ICAC, in ICAC 2006, when we saw the first 24-week results of raltegravir in a highly treatment-experienced patient population, a study called Protocol 005. And here at this meeting, we saw the 48-week results of that population. The results were essentially the standard dose-finding result in a phase 2 design. It was randomized and double-blind. Patients got either placebo or one of 3 doses of raltegravir with a optimized background regimen. To be in this study, people had to be, again, triple-class experienced and use an optimized background regimen in this study. There was a 24-week double-blind phase, and then afterwards there was an open-label phase in which patients could, if they did well on raltegravir, remain on it open-label. And there was also a crossover for people on the placebo arm who, if they had virologic failure or in the raltegravir arms, certainly had access to raltegravir as well. So it's a phase 2 study, which means that there's about 43 to 45 people per arm. This was, again, a dose-finding study. But what we learned from it was consistent with what we saw in benchmark. Who enrolled into this study was, again, typically patients, the typical patients with triple class experience. Their CD4s are 200, their viral loads around 4.6, 4.7 log, around 50,000. But these patients had a lot of resistance. For example, in terms of their phenotypic susceptibility score, again demonstrating a lack of complete activity, about half of the patients had an optimized background regimen with no fully active drug in the regimen other than raltegravir or the placebo, suggesting that most of these patients really had a lot of resistance to contend with. Nevertheless, raltegravir did dramatically improve the response rates, certainly to less than 50. Somewhere around 50 to 60% of patients, even a year later, had viral loads less than 50, in contrast with placebo, in which about 10% had their viral load suppressed to less than 50. So a dramatic illustration of this drug. In order to also understand the durability of response, they presented a Kaplan-Meier. And the Kaplan-Meier curves illustrate quite nicely that if we look at who failed on raltegravir, most of the virologic failure seems to occur in the first 24 weeks, meaning if you got to less than 50 by week 24, you typically seem to stay there, although they certainly didn't break it down as precisely as we might to answer that question of how predictive is a less than 50 at any given week. Nevertheless, if there was virologic failure on raltegravir, and there was in about 30 to 40% of patients, it seemed to happen usually in the first 24 weeks, after which failure was much less likely. Not surprisingly, the CD4 response was also much better on raltegravir, about 100-cell bump versus almost no change on the placebo arm. Now, if somebody didn't respond to raltegravir with virologic suppression, as about 30% didn't, there was raltegravir resistance. Indeed, of the 38 people who had virologic failure, almost all of them had integrase resistance. There's one of two pathways that raltegravir resistance has. It's what's called the 155 pathway or the 148 pathway. And in fact, at the time the samples were analyzed, most patients had, in fact, two or more resistance mutations, suggesting that this drug is either fully active in a good regimen or can select for resistance in non-suppressive regimens. So not surprisingly, the factors that predict resistance or suppression are, number one, how active is your regimen, the PSS score, did you use enfuvirtide or not, for example, and your viral load. Low viral load patients typically, once again, having a better chance of achieving suppression than do people with high viral loads in this and other studies. The safety of the drug looks very good, however. There were very few patients who had increase in transaminases. There was one or two overall in the raltegravir. There were very few other toxicities identified in the overall study. So the drug, certainly for 48 weeks in these patients, looked very well tolerated. Indeed, certainly as well tolerated as placebo for a lot of the toxicities that we look at, such as GI, headache, fatigue, and so on, it looked pretty similar to what we see on placebo. There were also no signals of problems of malignancies, as was seen in the benchmark trials. Certainly sick patients can develop malignancies, but no evidence from this trial that the difference that there's any important rate of malignancies, and certainly nothing different from what one might expect from this patient population. So I think what we can easily conclude is that this is an important drug, and used in a good regimen, the majority of patients can achieve virologic suppression to less than 50. In this study, about half the patients did, but certainly that half was based on how compromised their regimens were. As we define more and more successful combinations, we will see more patients having virologic suppression. And that was the theme of the Gilead integrase, because their drug called elvitegravir was presented to us for the first time at the retrovirus conference early 2007. And they delved into the study data one more time to help us understand this drug as well as the importance of a good background regimen. The design of this trial is very different. Again, it's dose finding, so there's a 60 to 70 people per arm. But the design of this is very different. These are triple class experienced patients who are randomized to either elvitegravir at one of three doses or a comparator PI. There was no protease inhibitor used in the elvitegravir arms. In this case, the background regimen was nucleosides with or without T20. Non-nucleosides weren't even allowed. This was an assessment of elvitegravir versus comparator PIs. Interestingly, about half the patients chose darunavir, and the other quarter took tipranavir, and the other quarter then taking other PIs that were available, such as lopinavir. And so what did we see in this study? What we saw in this study is exactly what we'd expect to see. The first finding, however, was unexpected, which is that the use of elvitegravir for the first 24 weeks was actually more successful than protease inhibitors. Indeed, The elvitegravir regimen got the viral load about a log lower than did the protease inhibitors. So whether you looked at the viral load out to week 24, to week 16, the overall results, particularly in the subset of people who had the use of T20 or enfuvirtide during the study, they had virologic suppression that was a log better on elvitegravir versus a comparative PI. Again, not surprising, a new drug in a new class doing better than a new drug from an existing class. But probably the single analysis that had the easiest way to summarize these data was an analysis by the background regimen. When they presented the analysis of the best dose, or at least the highest dose, the 125 milligram dose, out to week 24, the percent who got to less than 50 was clearly determined by how many active drugs were given with the raltegravir. For example, if raltegravir was given as essentially functional monotherapy, no other active drugs, 15% were less than 50 copies at week 16. If they had an active nucleoside, 30% got to less than 50. Two or more active nucleosides were up to 44%. And if somebody got enfuvirtide for the first time, a fully active drug of enfuvirtide plus a fully active drug elvitegravir with or without nucleosides, were up to 74% less than 50. Interestingly, that 74% response rate shown here is remarkably similar to what was seen in the benchmark trials, in which the combination of raltegravir and enfuvirtide certainly got the vast majority of patients less than 400. And certainly if we kind of subtract the numbers that might be different between 400 and 50, we see remarkably consistent findings here in which the vast majority of patients can get to less than 50 copies here with the use of two new drugs in two novel classes. And so I think what we've got now is evidence that we have two active protease inhibitors, one of which has obviously completed its phase 3 studies, the other which has identified a dose that could be brought forward into now phase 2, 3 testing. And so we've got yet another class of drugs now to work with in our field, the CCR5 inhibitors, maraviroc, of course, being the first FDA-approved drug in this class. And now at this meeting, we saw the 48-week results of one of the two pivotal studies for this drug called MOTIVATE. MOTIVATE was maraviroc or placebo in treatment-experienced patient populations. The design is typical for our treatment-experienced studies. It's maraviroc. In this study, either once a day or twice a day was tested versus placebo in a triple-class experienced patient population. Of note is that this study was also perhaps a bit hampered by the fact that darunavir was not used in this study because of how long ago this study was done versus the availability of darunavir, and tipranavir was used in only 10%. So the background was perhaps not as active as it might be at the current time, given changes in background regimens. So we do, however, see evidence that maraviroc is clearly an important drug, particularly the twice-a-day, which was FDA-approved. Even out to week 48, there was an additional log suppression associated with the use of maraviroc versus placebo, and we've got 2 to 3 times as many people whose viral load is less than 50 with maraviroc versus without. For example, at week 48, 16% on placebo had a viral load less than 50, 47%, 46.8 to be exact, on maraviroc had a viral load less than 50 copies. Again, supporting that this is an important drug with perhaps a 2 to 3-fold improvement in response rates, even with the relatively compromised background in terms of protease inhibitors that were available in this study. Again, not surprisingly, there's a good CD4 response, about a 70-cell difference favoring maraviroc at the twice-a-day regimen. But, of course, the baseline viral loads do influence response, and what they saw is that for patients whose viral load at baseline was below 100,000, 60% got to less than 50. In contrast, if somebody had a viral load of over 100,000, only 30% did, once again illustrating just how important the entire regimen is going to be for these very high viral load patients, and certainly the reason why it's so good that we have so many active drugs in our field at this point in time. For example, they illustrated that point by looking at the enfuvirtide data. When patients used enfuvirtide for the first time in this study, they 64% of them got their viral loads less than 50. In contrast, if somebody didn't use enfuvirtide or recycled it, then only 30% got to less than 50, illustrating once again just how important it is to have an active regimen, not just single active drugs. The great news for maraviroc continues to be also not just how well it works, but how well it's tolerated. There doesn't seem to be all that much difference from placebo overall in terms of adverse events, in terms of subjective toxicities. There are a few more percent of people who had some upper respiratory tract infections and a cough, but certainly not more than that, and only in a few percent difference. No evidence of an increase in AIDS-related events, and certainly very little evidence of differences in LFT increases. There were a couple of grade 3 ALT increases on Miravrox versus the control, although we were reassured by the presenter, Jay Lalazari, that in Motivate 2, the companion trial, the results were, in fact, the opposite, that there weren't increases in transaminases. The last point, which was the focus of not just one presentation, but in fact two, which is an important concern for this class, which is not just response rates, but what are the implications of not responding? First of all, if you're using an R5 inhibitor, what is going to happen in patients who don't respond? And we've learned for some time now that what we are going to see typically are viruses that are dual mixed or X4 tropic. Indeed, in this study on the Miravrox twice a day arm, about 2/3 of the patients who rebounded with a dual mixed tropic virus population. Again, recall that everybody in this study had to have CCR5 tropic virus to be eligible at baseline. But at the time of failure, 2/3 of the patients emerged with dual mixed virus. We understand this to be essentially because at baseline, people have dual mixed virus. Even in patients who are screened out, they might have some small amount of dual mixed virus that is hidden amongst their virus population. And if you use an R5 inhibitor and it's not fully suppressive, it's the dual mixed virus that has the advantage. But then the question is, so what? Does it matter? The good news so far is, at least at the time of failure, people who rebound with R5 populations seem to have a pretty good CD4 response as a result of their participation in study. In one analysis, they had about a 100-cell bump on Miravrox, even at the time of virologic failure. But if somebody emerged with dual mixed virus, they still had a pretty good CD4 response, although the CD4 response in that case was not different from placebo. Nevertheless, they certainly didn't have any evidence of harm as a result of rebounding with a dual mixed population. It was just then no better than the placebo group in that particular case. And that's been a concern for a while of, you know, if we unmask the dual mixed virus, will we then cause some destruction of CD4s? And so far, the news is reassuring, we don't. We may not get the benefit of R5s, but we certainly don't seem to be creating harm, at least in the short term of these studies. So what we've learned so far is Miravrox looks like an important drug in these treatment-experienced populations. It provides substantial activity in an R5 screen population. And so once again, we have another opportunity to take a pretty easy drug to work with and create a good regimen around it. So again, reassuring news of some of the drugs that are in phase 2, 3, and some good news that there continues to be a pipeline behind these drugs.
Well, a great wrap-up. Thank you so much, Dr. Cohen, for being with us and for your comprehensive analysis of ICAC 2007.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
I'm here now with Dr. Eric Dar, Chief of HIV Medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles, California, and a Professor of Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, David Geffen School of Medicine. We've asked Dr. Dar to discuss the key research presented at ICAC relating to HIV heart complications. Welcome, Dr. Dar. Could you talk a little bit about some of the more interesting presentations on HIV drug resistance at ICAC?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of presentations of particular interest related to drugs that are currently available. In particular, there was an additional analysis from the TITAN trial. And many remember this was a study that was published over the summer in Lancet and presented for the first time at the International AIDS Society meeting in Sydney. And this was a randomized controlled trial of treatment-experienced patients who were lopinavir-ritonavir naive, who were then randomly assigned to a regimen that either included lopinavir-ritonavir or darunavir-ritonavir, the standard twice-a-day dose that's currently approved. So this was an opportunity to look how these two ritonavir-boosted PIs compared directly head-to-head, as opposed to the original POWER trials with darunavir-ritonavir, which just compared it to a comparator PI that was selected by the investigator. And they attempted in the study to pick out a group of people who were likely to be susceptible to both drugs by making them lopinavir-ritonavir naive. And as you may recall, the results of this study was that they were able to demonstrate non-inferiority of darunavir-ritonavir to lopinavir-ritonavir. And in fact, in a secondary analysis, they showed that darunavir-ritonavir was actually superior for the primary endpoint to lopinavir-ritonavir. The difficulties in interpreting the study were that there was a little bit of imbalance at baseline and that there were more people who had resistance in the lopinavir-ritonavir arm to the assigned PI than in the other arm. And certainly this could have influenced the results and is a limitation of the study because, in general, in clinical practice, we'd have resistance data and we wouldn't use a drug in which there's resistance if we had alternatives. So there was this modest difference. And what they looked at in this particular follow-up analysis is to further define the amount of resistance that emerged in the people who experienced virologic failure. So they looked at baseline resistance patterns and then looked at it over time. And what they showed was that there was more new resistance in both nucleosides and the protease inhibitor class in those who received lopinavir-ritonavir than darunavir-ritonavir. Now, part of this, one might argue, is related to the fact that there was more baseline resistance in the lopinavir-ritonavir group. So they attempted to adjust for that by narrowing the analysis to those who had less than tenfold resistance to lopinavir-ritonavir, a population of people that, based on the phenotype, we would consider using that drug in the clinical trial or in clinical practice. And they found even in this group that there was still a difference in the number of new mutations that occurred in the patients who were on lopinavir-ritonavir than darunavir-ritonavir. There are limitations to the analysis as far as the ability to look at specific mutations, but at least it does suggest that within the one group there's less new resistance than in the other. How we ultimately will use this in clinical practice, I think, is that we'll still rely very heavily on genotypic and phenotypic data to pick which protease inhibitor to include in the optimized regimen, recognizing that in this particular study, both arms did very, very well, despite some imbalances. Another study of interest related to non-nucleoside resistance sort of deals with the issue of how to stop people on therapy that include NNRTIs. Now, the problem here is that we've generally told people in the past that if they're going to stop therapy, they should stop all the drugs at the same time. But we've come to appreciate that NNRTIs, both efavirenz and nevirapine, have very long half-lives. In fact, can have levels, inhibitory levels, present in the drug in the blood for days or even several weeks after stopping the drug. And the concern is if they stop a regimen of two nucleosides and an NNRTI all at the same time, after about 24 to 48 hours, the nucleoside levels are down, but the NNRTI levels persist, and that could very quickly select for high-level resistance to NNRTIs. And in fact, there's clinical data showing that this does happen in some people who stop all of their drugs simultaneously when one of those drugs is an NNRTI. So based on that, there's not a lot of clinical data to guide what investigators or clinicians should do in this setting. What's been proposed is that we either switch people from the NNRTI in the regimen to a protease inhibitor, continue them on their nukes and protease inhibitor for several weeks or a month, and then stop all of them at the same time so that the NNRTI is out of the system. Another strategy is to somehow cover the extended levels of the NNRTI by continuing the nucleosides. So some people have proposed what we should do if we're going to stop therapy in a controlled way is to stop the NNRTI and continue the nucleosides for some period of time and then stop them with the hope that by the time you stop the nucleosides, the non-nucleoside levels will have declined to below those that are clinically relevant. But as I mentioned, there's not a lot of clinical data. So the Thai group, who performed a CD4-guided treatment interruption study, went and retrospectively analyzed the subset of patients who were on NNRTIs, either efavirenz or nevirapine, who then stopped therapy because their CD4 cells were sufficiently high per the protocol, and then needed to restart. And that allowed them the opportunity to determine if there was indeed resistance to NNRTIs prior to restarting therapy, as well as whether they had adequate suppression. And in the protocol, in the absence of data, what they recommended was that people continue the nucleoside for 7 to 10 days. So one of the strategies that we've actually suggested might work was tested in this study. And what they found were there were 43 individuals who met that criteria of having stopped an NNRTI, having with the continuation of the nucleosides as outlined in their protocol, and then restarted. And they found that none of these people had evidence of resistance at the time they were about to restart therapy, and 100% of the patients resuppressed on a non-nucleoside-containing regimen. So again, there are limitations of this study. There was no control group. We don't know that they wouldn't have all behaved the same way had they not had nucleosides for 7 to 10 days, but at least it's some clinical data that suggests that this might be a viable strategy.
With the widespread use of tenofovir, renal complications in HIV-infected patients have become more of a concern. At almost every conference nowadays, there are presentations on the subject. Anything at ICAC?
Yeah, investigators continue to try to look at this very carefully because there have been case reports and case series of tenofovir-associated renal disease, and we are using this drug commonly now and for long periods of time. So it's important to look at it very carefully. And we also recognize that, at least in the clinical trials, that they often systematically exclude people who are at high risk for renal disease or particularly have underlying renal insufficiency. There were two groups at this meeting that looked at cohorts to try to identify and select out people who were at high risk. And one of them was a group from the University of Maryland, where they have a high-risk population, largely African-American, who we know are at higher risk for many of the comorbid conditions associated with renal disease, like diabetes and hypertension, as well as HIV-associated nephropathy. And indeed, some of these people did have diabetes and hypertension. And they looked at two populations, a population of about 150 people who received tenofovir-containing regimens and 68 that received abacavir-containing regimens. And then they followed them over time. It turned out at the baseline there were some differences between the two groups. In particular, the people who received tenofovir tended to be a little bit younger, and they actually had somewhat higher glomerular filtration rates, about 10% higher at baseline. They followed them over time, and what they found was that there was about an 8 to 10% reduction in glomerular filtration rate amongst those who received tenofovir compared to abacavir. Most of the reduction occurred very early, and there were very few. In fact, 4 out of 149, or 3% of the patients in the tenofovir group, that actually discontinued therapy due to a decreased glomerular filtration rate versus none of the group in the abacavir-treated patients. So I think this study, like others, shows that there probably is an effect, it's real, but it tends to be modest and probably is only clinically relevant in a very small proportion of people. Take-home message is that we continue need to use this drug carefully and monitor our patients' renal function. Now, Ben Young presented data from the HOPS cohort, also trying to identify a unique population of patients that were particularly high risk. Recognizing the limitations of previous studies, they looked towards the HOP cohort, which is the HIV outpatient study, and they identified people who had low glomerular filtration rates or significant renal disease in the past or presently. And in fact, they found 19 people that fell into their criteria of either having past renal insufficiency with a creatinine of less than 1.5 with a creatinine clearance of over 50, or 13 patients who had current renal disease with a creatinine of greater than or equal to 1.5 and or a creatinine clearance of less than 50. And they followed these people over time with a median follow-up of about 13 months. And they found in these patients, again, a group that had bad disease in the past or presently who received tenofovir, that most did not experience any significant worsening of their kidney function during the course of 13 months of follow-up. Now, obviously, 13 months isn't very long. They need more follow-up. But again, it's a suggestion or a clue that this may not be a big problem even in people with underlying renal disease, at least as long as you monitor them closely.
Although there wasn't much at ICAC focusing on HIV metabolic complications, there was one presentation by Pablo Tabas that was interesting. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Pablo presented data from ACTG 5102, which was a trial that took patients who were on stable antiretroviral therapy with complete suppression and good T cells. It was actually an interleukin-2 and treatment interruption study. And their focus was really on what effect treatment interruption had on factors that they thought might be relevant in the context of cardiovascular disease. And the background for this is the identification in several other treatment interruption studies of increased cardiovascular events, perhaps the most notable being the SMART trial, where people were randomly assigned to either continue therapy or stop it until their CD4 counts got to less than 250. And as people know, that study was stopped prematurely because increased risks for progression and non-HIV-related events, including some cardiovascular disease. It's led people to speculate that having uncontrolled viremia may create a situation either metabolically or from an inflammatory perspective that would put people at risk. So what they did in this study is they looked very carefully at the time of treatment interruption at changes in lipids, glucose, insulin levels, as well as immune activation. And what they found was that as soon as therapy was stopped, very quickly, there were no changes in glucose or insulin, but there were dramatic changes in total cholesterol. Total cholesterol went down and LDL went down. And all of that would suggest something favorable from a cardiovascular perspective. However, HDL also went down, and this has been seen in other studies. And when you looked at the important total cholesterol HDL ratio, it turned out that there was really no change because of the balance in what happened with LDL versus HDL. So they proposed, based on this observation, that most of the lipid abnormalities are driven directly by the drugs themselves, and that being off therapy would not create an increased atherogenic state, to try to explain what was observed in the SMART trial and a few other studies like it. When they looked at immune activation, they demonstrated what's also been shown before, and that there's a fairly quick increase in immune activation that correlates very closely with viral rebound in people who are fully suppressed and then stop therapy. And they saw over a 30% increase in CD8 cell activation using a CD38 as a marker and tumor necrosis factor receptor. So two markers of immune activation. And they proposed, although it by no means shows a direct link, that perhaps this increase in the activation state could be associated with pro-inflammatory mediators, which have been associated with cardiovascular disease. I think what the field needs now is some direct evidence that this kind of inflammation is actually linked to cardiovascular disease.
With the approval of Miravarac, knowledge about tropism and tropism assays is suddenly in focus. Can you discuss some of the presentations that you noticed?
There were a couple of presentations that I think are going to be relevant as we move forward with clinical trials and with the availability of a new CCR5 antagonist. One of them relates as more about pathogenesis, and that's what is the clinical relevance of these different viruses that use different co-receptors. And the reason this is important is, as you know, the CCR5 antagonists block R5 viruses. They don't block viruses that use the CXCR4 receptor. And in the clinical trials and in the population that we'll be treating in the clinics, they're targeting those who are R5 only. And one of the consequences that we've seen in these studies is the emergence of dual mixed tropic or X4 viruses, both of which use the CXCR4 receptor. One of the concerns is that there are natural history studies that suggest that viruses that seem to be related to what we now refer to as CXCR4 utilizing viruses, the so-called syncytium-inducing viruses, in the past have been associated with CD4 decline and disease progression. There's now data using new assays, the ones we'll be using in the clinic to define tropism, showing that the same thing is true in natural history cohorts in people who have dual mixed tropic or X4 virus. In fact, our group just published a paper in CID that showed that in a hemophiliac cohort, people who had dual mixed tropic or X4 virus were at almost fourfold increased risk of progression to clinical AIDS and death, even after adjusting for viral load and CD4 count. Another study here looked at a population of adults and showed very similar results. And Matt Goetz studied patients from CPCRA060, and they looked at a subset of people who were treatment naive and over 350 T cells. And they sent plasma samples in over 300 of these patients to Monogram Biosciences, where they performed the tropism assay that's currently being used and is licensed in clinical practice. And they found that about 10% of the population of patients had evidence of dual mixed tropic or X4 virus, almost all dual mixed tropic, with the remaining patients being R5 only. And they demonstrated very convincingly that those who had dual mixed tropic or X4 virus were at increased risk for progression to this composite endpoint that they defined as having a CD4 count of less than 350, needing to start therapy, which occurred at the discretion of their provider, or death. And they were able to adjust for baseline viral load and T cell count and show that even independent of that, there was about a twofold increased risk of progression to this composite endpoint amongst those who had dual mixed tropic or X4 virus. So it's from those kinds of natural history studies that we worry if dual mixed tropic viruses emerge. The good news is that at least so far in the clinical trials, the people who have selected out this population of viruses do not seem to be experiencing any adverse consequences such as CD4 decline. And as was discussed at this meeting with the 48-week data from the MOTIVATE trial and now up to 3 years of follow-up in people who are receiving Vicrivirac, even though many of these people who failed with dual mixtropic and X4 virus, again, there doesn't appear to be any obvious adverse consequences. In order to deal with the fact that some people are failing with this viral population, it is extremely important to make sure that our initial screening tests work, because there is evidence that there is a low proportion of viruses that can be present below the limits of detection of the assay, very similar to what we've dealt with in drug resistance testing. What we don't see can be important. And from all of the studies that have been done so far, when you look at people who come in and get screened and are found to be R5 only, there's about another 5 or 10% who, between screening and entry, without the introduction of any therapy at all, just the passage of time, suddenly now have detectable dual mixed or X4 virus. And presumably these are viral populations that are just below the limits of detection. There is also data presented here in follow-up from the MOTIVATE trial showing that those who fail early in therapy tend to be the ones failing with dual mixtropic virus, along with other data that all support the fact that much of this is pre-selection of a viral population that existed before therapy was ever initiated. So there's been a lot of interest in trying to improve the quality of the assays, as well as perhaps come up with simpler assays. So the Monogram group, who developed the currently available and licensed assay for tropism, have been working on modifying it, and they presented a poster here showing that they were able to, just by simply manipulating the assay they currently use, to perhaps increase the sensitivity to detect these low-level dual mixtropic X4 virus that may have been missed with the standard assay currently being used and was used in the clinical trials. I think the next best step after they've sort of refined this assay adequately is to go back and perhaps look at some of the baseline specimens in people in large controlled trials and try to get a sense as to how detection at low levels may have contributed to or predicted the risk of failure. And that might be very helpful as we think about moving forward with a newer, perhaps more sensitive assay in the future. And then finally, they also tried to determine whether an alternative strategy could be used to their tropism assay. And others are trying to work on assays very much like theirs, but also trying to see if we can have a complementary genotypic assay. And we know that viral envelope mediates tropism, and much of that is in the context of the V3 loop, the hypervariable loop of the envelope. So they attempted to sequence that and see how that related to their phenotypic assessment. And their conclusions were that, one, it's very difficult to sequence that area, and that's been true when others have looked at it as well, because there's a lot of insertions and deletions and variability in the V3 loop, much different than in polymerase or protease genes. And also they found that it was not terribly sensitive for detecting dual mixed or X4 virus. And again, that's completely consistent with a lot of groups who've looked at this independently of them. So I think for now, genotype is not likely to be a strategy for the future, but perhaps enhanced phenotypic assays, both from Monogram and maybe other groups, may improve our ability to detect low levels dual mix X4 virus and may also result in better response rates with the CCR5 antagonists, which already look to be very promising.
Dr. Dock, can you talk a little bit about the pricing of this test and how it's going to be afforded by all the clinics across the country?
Well, I think that's a really important question because it is an additional test. And if there's one thing that seems clear, and that if we're going to use a CCR5 antagonist, we really do need the results of this test. Upwards of 40 to 50% of people who are highly treatment experienced, the population that we're going to be targeting with this drug, have viruses that use CXCR4 and are not likely to be good candidates, in which case all we're doing is subjecting these people to cost of a drug and toxicity. So we need to use the test. But the test is going to be expensive, as these tests tend to be, and we're going to need to see how that negotiation occurs between the company or whoever else comes up with an assay like this and the third-party payers. But it's going to be vital for both the patients and really to not inappropriately utilize this class of drugs. And then the issue will come up, okay, that's all fine and good when you do it at baseline. Do we then do it again and people experience virologic failure? And again, that's going to probably be driven by availability because intuitively to me, it makes sense that we would. If somebody experiences virologic failure on a regimen, we do resistance testing and follow-up to see what the next regimen should be. I think the same is probably going to need to be true with the tropism assay. T20, almost everybody who fails on T20 has evidence of resistance. We know from the MOTIVATE trials that amongst the people who fail, while two-thirds of them had dual-mix virus, a third didn't. And in the Vicrovirox trials, it was closer to 50 or 60% didn't. So it may make sense to be able to look at that and decide whether this drug should be continued as part of the next regimen.
Eric, I was wondering if you could now talk a little bit about the presentations focusing on non-AIDS-defining complications.
Yeah, over the last several years, I think there's been increased interest in this. We've tended to focus on our clinical endpoints and trials and natural history studies as progression to AIDS and AIDS-defining illnesses and malignancies. And over the last several years, as we've looked more closely at people, sometimes in earlier stages of disease or off therapy, we've come to appreciate that there are other unique complications that may prove to be extremely important as well and may drive, in part, decisions about when to start therapy and when not to stop therapy. And there were two presentations that I thought were particularly relevant here. One was from the French group, where they looked at a population of patients that were enrolled between 1997 and 1999. There were 1,280 of them who were started on a protease inhibitor-containing regimen. So this is a group of over 1,000 individuals who were thought that they were needed to start on some antiretroviral therapy at the time, and then they were followed. And there was a median follow-up in this analysis of 88 months, so it's quite prolonged follow-up. And they looked for a variety of different events, including non-AIDS and non-antiretroviral therapy-related adverse events, and that they found that there were many. Most common were bacterial infections, about 23%. There were about 10% developed malignancies. And then there were about another 10% that had cardiovascular disease and some psychiatric and neurologic events. And what they did was a multivariate analysis to try to tease out factors that were associated with increased risk for these specific events. And they found that, not too surprisingly, older age, based on the nature of these events, like malignancies and cardiovascular disease, was independently associated with increased risk. They found hep C positivity was, and this might be for a variety of reasons, including hepatitis C-related liver disease. But more importantly, in the CD4 count, they found that an important factor in the multivariate analysis was having a CD4 count of less than 100. And again, these are for non-AIDS or treatment-related events. And other studies have shown the same thing, that while we think about people being immune-suppressed being at risk for AIDS-defining illnesses, they may also be at increased risk for these other things. And then perhaps the most interesting observation was that when you looked at plasma viral load, they found that having a viral load of greater than 10,000 was significantly increased risk factor, independent of other factors, including baseline CD4s and current CD4s, for these various events. And particularly, this was driven by the increased occurrence of bacterial infections. And the authors conclude, I think appropriately, that in a group of patients who were on antiretroviral therapy, having detectable viremia, in this case particularly above 10,000, regardless of what therapy they're on or their T-cell count, is a risk factor for adverse consequences or outcomes. And again, not necessarily AIDS-related. So arguing strongly against treatment interruptions in a population of patients like this, it's a little bit more of a reach to suggest that this has implications for when to start therapy, because that's not the population they looked at. But I think it supports the idea that we do need to look at that closely when we think about the best time to start therapy, meaning looking at non-AIDS-related issues. Another poster looked at non-AIDS-related or non-AIDS-defining malignancies, which again has come out of a variety of studies as being important and associated with the level of immune function as well. This was a study from the VA where they looked at the VA electronic medical record system and looked at ICD-9 codes. And they were able to identify for this analysis 33,400 HIV positive and 66,800 HIV negative veterans who were followed for a median of 5 to 6.5 years. And they looked at the incident rates of non-AIDS-related malignancies, and they showed that the incident rate ratio for these events in HIV positives was 1.6, or 60% higher than what was seen in the HIV negatives. And when they looked at which particular malignancies occurred more often, there was a 15-fold increased risk amongst the HIV positives for anal cancer. There was a 2-fold increased risk for lung cancer. And if you think about it, some of this may be driven by other comorbid issues. Anal cancer almost certainly is related to HPV infection. lung cancer probably associated with increased smoking amongst this population, and they couldn't adjust for that, but there may be other issues. Melanoma occurred with increased frequency. Hodgkin's disease, which has been seen in a variety of trials, also occurred with an increased frequency amongst those with HIV. Liver cancer, probably related to hepatitis C and B co-infection. But overall, again, an increased risk and a relationship in most of these cases between the CD4 count as well. The people with HIV and these malignancies tended to have lower CD4 cells than those with HIV who didn't have the malignancies.
Finally, we're going to close with a discussion of HIV co-infections, notably hepatitis B and C. Anything that will change practice?
Boy, you know, it's difficult to say, but I think that there has been some significant advances. One presentation related to entecavir's effect on HIV and the selection for 184V has already changed practice. This was reported some time ago, has recently been published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was the observation that entecavir actually has HIV activity. Prior to this, it was thought that it did not and was recommended as one of the options for somebody who was co-infected, who you want to treat their Hep B but not their HIV. But what emerged from a few carefully studied cases is that you do indeed select for the 184V in a subset of patients. There was further analysis performed here by this group to try to better understand molecularly why there may be differences in the proportion of people that select for it and how it evolves. And there may be some relationship between differences in the fitness effect of the 184V in the setting of entecavir with HIV. But the bottom line is right now, it clearly is a drug with HIV activity, and the new guidelines suggest that it should not be used except in somebody who is on antiretroviral therapy, at least in HIV-infected individuals, of course. So I think that's already changed the practice. Another study that might influence what people do in the clinic looked at the possibility of retreating people for hepatitis C with pegylated interferon and weight-based ribavirin, particularly a group of people that may not have been adequately treated the first time. So the question is, if I had somebody who I had treated with interferon monotherapy at a time when we did that, or interferon, pegylated interferon with ribavirin, but not weight-based ribavirin. Often studies and patient care was 800 milligrams rather than up to 1,000 or 1,200 milligrams. If somebody had failed those earlier regimens, it may have been inadequate. What is the value of trying to retreat them with what's now the current standard of care? And they did that in a group of patients who did experience failure in the past. Some of these people, again, monotherapy, some just not the best dose of ribavirin. And what they found was that there actually was a response rate. Overall, about 39% of patients had a sustained virologic response. 27%, or a quarter of those who had genotype 1 and 4, and 70% of those who had genotype 2 and 3. So I think the data set is small, and I don't think you can be sure that any given patient is going to be able to respond, but it does provide some evidence to try to support revisiting treatment with patients who have failed previous therapy. And it's nice to be able to have at least something to go to the patient with, since you are proposing to subject them to considerable toxicity in the attempt to retreat them. Now, unfortunately, despite the fact that we have treatment for hepatitis C in both people with and without HIV, it's not always successful, and particularly with the genotype 1s in co-infected patients. A large proportion of people don't respond to therapy or don't tolerate therapy. And as you know, one of the most common reasons why people need liver transplants is because of end-stage hepatitis C disease. There's been very slow movement over the years, although it's picked up some pace in studies and even in practice, the introduction of liver transplantation in patients with HIV, in particular because of concerns that immunosuppressing people who are already immunosuppressed may have detrimental effects. And we've seen data emerge from various countries over the last several years showing that overall, patients who are co-infected with hepatitis C with liver failure who get liver transplants seem to do fairly well. There was another study presented here looking at the 3-year survival of Hep C HIV co-infected patients who had liver transplantation. They had 51 of these individuals, and they compared them to a control group of almost 1,200 HCV mono-infected individuals. They followed them over time. Now, these patients, very much like others in trials, tended to be people who either were on fully suppressive therapy, or it was felt that because of their treatment history that they could be successfully treated. So it's a population of people that could be treated well for their HIV. And overall, the survival at 3 years was very good across all of the patients in both groups, and 3-year survival was essentially the same, 64% and 69%, amongst those with HIV versus those who were hep C mono-infected. And hopefully, with this kind of data, liver transplantation will be more accessible to people who are co-infected with liver failure and need it as their one option. And then finally, preliminary data was presented on novel drugs for hepatitis C. And certainly there's a great need here, since current therapy with pegylated interferon and ribavirin is associated with considerable toxicity and relatively low response rates, particularly for the more common genotype 1s. And there's been an active development program looking at new drugs, including hepatitis C virus protease inhibitors, and clinical trials adding them on to standard of care, PEG interferon and ribavirin. And Mark Sulkowski presented preliminary data from the PROVE-1 study using this Vertex 05950 compound. And they had subjects that were followed longitudinally after starting on treatment in one of several different groups with pegylated interferon and ribavirin and this new drug at 750 milligrams given every 8 hours. And once everybody got to 12 weeks, then they started to do an interim analysis. And they found pretty extraordinary response rates, at least in this very preliminary look. At week 4, 79% of them had hep C viral loads that were below the limits of detection, compared to only 11% in the control group. And at week 12, 70% continued to have undetectable levels versus 39% of the control group. So very promising as we move forward with a new strategy and new novel therapeutics for hepatitis C, with the hope that eventually we'll be able to successfully treat everybody and prevent the consequences or sequelae of hep C infection, liver failure, and then the need for transplantation.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dar, for taking the time to speak with us and for your incisive analysis.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a CME and CE podcast report from ICAC 2007. To learn more about this CME and CE activity and to access additional coverage of ICAC 2007, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/ICAAC